Right now, it's time to welcome Jim Sogard to our studios. Jim is an author, has written a book on moths and caterpillars of the North Woods, kind of an overview of sort of the more common of the moths and caterpillars you're likely to come in contact with in the North Woods. Jim, good morning.
Yes, good morning. And thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no doubt. We're always thrilled to have you with us. Just as an overview, just as a quick aside, how many species of moths could there be in northern Minnesota?
Well, it's not very well sampled and known, but probably in the state of Minnesota, and they generally have pretty wide ranges, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,500. And those all would... not all of them in northern Minnesota, but I would guess the majority of them would occur there, more or less.
So any book trying to just even begin to cover the subject is going to fall a little bit short of the 2,500 possibilities, I would imagine.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to ask you, first of all, about some of the early season moths, because as I have been observing nature for all of these years, it's always about this time of year that, one evening I'll be either headed into town or out of town, and this moth will appear kind of spiraling into my headlight, and I always feel bad for him. But what prompts a moth to get started so early, and who are these guys?
Well, there's a bunch of them, and they all kind of look similar with a couple of exceptions. They've got many fancy scientific names, which I won't tell you, but they've got names like sallows and swordgrasses and pinions and woodlings, and they're all kind of, they tend to be kind of drab in coloration. They tend to be kind of browns and grays, and a couple of them have some green streaking in them, and there's one, excuse me, one in particular that is noteworthy called the Joker, that is sometimes bright green.
Oh.
But they're not all that common.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, some of these will come to sugar, but the Joker does not, so you couldn't expect to see that guy at your maple sugar bucket.
Yeah, so who is the guy that comes to my maple sap bucket?
Well, there's a bunch that are called sallows, and they tend to be kind of yellow in color.
Mm-hmm. That looks...
a brownish yellow,
yep.
Or ochre.
Yep.
You might get some swordgrasses. They're a little bit bigger and a little bit more elongate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of them that are grays and browns and tans that are called pinions. And those would be common visitors. And that's not the whole list, of course, but... those would be very common things to show up at your maple sugar.
And I'm not sure if it was you or if it's something I read in your book or maybe it was something I picked up somewhere else, but the moths of early spring sort of divide out into two groups. One is kind of big, furry, and fat, and one, yes, is kind of skinny and not furry at all. And maybe you could describe a little bit what I'm talking about to the people, and then explain how that affects their lifestyle.
Sure, yeah. The big fat ones, that would be the majority of what you would see early in the year, and they tend to be, their common name would be owlet moths, so-called, because they have eye shine. If you shine a light on their eyes at night, you'll oftentimes get a back glow. In the family Noctuidae, and they're the fat ones with the heavy coats of scales on them to insulate them. And they, I like to say they fly hot because they're well insulated and they've got all kinds of fancy circulatory devices to help heat up the wing flight muscles, whereas the rest of the body stays pretty cold. And so they have to get warm to be able to generate the power to flap their wings many times a second, perhaps many tens of times per second, to carry that weight around. And so that's the majority. And then you've got a few of the little delicate, frail-looking things in the family Geometridae. And those things are tiny, and they look so frail, but they actually do not heat up. And they've got relatively large wings compared to their body weight. And so they can fly at temperatures down to freezing. And they can do that without heating their bodies up at all,
yeah.
Which is an amazing thing. How something that looks so frail can fly at freezing, literally at freezing. Their body temperature is at freezing.
Yeah, I work in this science experiment, climate change experiment up north, and they have these greenhouses that are relative. Well, one is at ambient air temperature, and then there are four more that are warmer than that. But even in the ambient temperature plots, I have been seeing these Geometridae moths, little black, white kind of winged moths, but, you know, the wingspan on them is roughly a half an inch.
Yes. Yeah, that could be the spring cankerworm. That would be my first guess. But, of course, there are some other options, too.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, some of the early flying adults that we see now have been adults all since last fall.
Oh, really?
Some of them newly emerged from pupae in the spring, but in fact they have been fully formed adults within the pupa all winter.
Oh.
And so if you look at a pupa and say it's a pupa, that doesn't necessarily tell you the whole story. There may be a fully formed adult in there. That's kind of their way of being adults without being out in the world, so to speak.
Huh.
And then some of them are actually migrants. They come up from the south.
Wow.
And some of them ride rivers of air high in the sky that travel at good speed, and they can cover hundreds of miles in several nights. And,
wow.
Oh, some of them are, coming. And those migrants are incapable, so far anyway, of surviving our winters up here. So we know that they are coming north each spring, more or less.
Maybe
in the future they will be permanent.
Yeah, well, it'll be folks like you that'll figure that out.
Yes.
And what's the two questions? One, how do they survive? What do they use to survive? What's their food source when they get here? And what's the advantage of coming out so early? I'm sorry, that's three questions, isn't it?
The presumed advantages would be to avoid predators. I don't know if there are any healthy bats, anyway, that are out flying in the winter. Once in a while, I think they may, when they're sick, they may fly in the winter.
Yeah.
But bats would be avoided by being so early. Nesting birds with high demands for their nestlings to feed insects, they would be partly avoided. Of course, none of these are absolute avoidances. Those are the presumed big reason, one big reason. The other one is that when trees first break their leaf buds in the spring, that new foliage is very tender. It's poorly chemically defended, and it's got a lot of water in it, which is also a nutrition element for a moth.
Wow.
So getting there to the table while the eating is good is part of it, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
And I forget another part of your question.
Well, I was curious about and you covered that, what they might eat. How do they survive cold?
Well, they hunker down mostly. They hunker down under the leaf litter, and then presumably that gets covered with snow. Some of them may end up in caves or cracked foundations or old wells inside hollow trees, but they basically shut their body temperature way down, and so that's a big part of it. But I remember what you asked before: what fuels them? Well, partly they just avoid burning fuel, but partly some of them do feed on sugar, and the ones that don't feed on sugar, they're living on the fat that was gathered by the caterpillars. So some of these adults, they're totally dependent on the hard work of the caterpillar that gathered all that nutrition in that stage of life.
Astonishing.
Yeah,
listen, we go ahead.
That was pretty much my thought there.
Okay, we've got a couple minutes left. I'd like you to describe your recipe for a mash to attract moths, and then maybe talk briefly about some of the really stunning moths that we have here in Minnesota that will be available for study a little bit later on in the spring and summer.
Yeah, the mash is, I know you can get elaborate recipes, and some people really dote on their particular recipes, but I've found anything that's got sugar in it and has sat around for a few days with some yeast in it, so that it can cook a bit at room temperature.
I was just thinking, Jim, we're talking about alcohol here.
Yes, we are, in part. There are some other things, too, that are fragrant and bring them in. But,
sure.
You know, some people really dote on diluted maple syrup or, you know, bananas or their particular brand of beverage. Personally, I don't think it really makes that much difference. But there are... just about anything sweet and sticky and a little bit fermented will do the job.
Perfect. And some of the stars.
Ahead.
Give me some of the stars of the spring and summer nights.
Oh, man. June, if you can deal with the mosquitoes, it's well worth it, because that's when the giant silk moths are flying for the most part, mid-May to late June or even mid-July. And that's when you get the big... giants, the Cecropias and the pale green Luna moths and the Polyphemus and just beautiful moths, the Ios with their bright yellow and,
yeah,
and their stunning eye spots and so forth.
Yeah.
Those, I would say, would strike most people as being the real show business aspect of moths. But there are many, many, many others that... occur year-round that are really stunning.
Yeah, well, I would encourage listeners to pick up Jim's book on moths and caterpillars of the North Woods, and you won't be disappointed. I know that in looking at it myself, I have just been fascinated. And as you say, there are those Hollywood stars, but there are some absolutely gorgeous moths that you seldom see, that or when you do see them, you're just blown away by the fact that they're not huge, but they're gorgeous. They're just absolutely beautiful.
Yes, and the behavior as well. I mean, the way some of these things contort themselves when they are so-called at rest is quite amazing, as their physical appearance itself. The physical appearance and their behavior in perching. Perching behavior, basically, is they really, it's amazing how they fit hand in glove.
Hmm.
And they create such, cryptic appearances that it's very easy to mistake them for a dead leaf or something such as that.
Yeah, there's one that I've discovered, and I'm lost for the name, you'll know it immediately, looks like birch bark.
Yeah,
kind of a medium-sized moth, and it's got white with...
That could be the white underwing.
That's it, the white underwing.
They are
yeah.
beautiful.
Yes. Just gorgeous.
And they, of course, spend the whole winter as eggs on the tree bark, in crevices in tree bark.
So okay, excellent.
You won't see them flying until, later summer into the fall.
All right. Jim, it's always a thrill to talk to you. I plan on having you back again this summer, and we'll talk about some of the moths of that time of the year. Thanks for joining us.
All right. You're certainly welcome, John. Thanks for having me on, and have a nice spring.
Thank you.